The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This series of California-based podcasts is brought to you in partnership with the Serica Initiative, our nonprofit program. The mission of the Serica Initiative is to produce independent educational and public awareness programming to make the U.S. and global public better informed about China. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original writing on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access, and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates over 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and today I am at Stanford University, the penultimate stop in Seneca's tour of California. A few years back, when Jeremy and I were still doing the show from Beijing, we had a terrific young intern at Seneca named Cole. Today, we are here to talk with Cole's dad, Mike, or at least that's how I know him. Most people call him Ambassador Michael McFaul, who served as ambassador to Russia during the second Obama administration from January of 2012 until February of 2014. Mike is the author most recently of From Cold War to Hot Peace, which is an excellent memoir of his Russian sojourns that I have recommended before on this show. That book details the many reasons why, at the Helsinki summit between Trump and Putin in July of 2018, Vladimir Putin asked to interview him along with Bill Browder. We are grateful that you weren't renditioned. And Mike, I promise this interview will be considerably gentler than the one you might have had with the FSB in Moscow. Welcome to Cynical, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming by.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. So people naturally associate you with Russia. That's where your expertise really lies. Mm-hmm. But of late, you have taken quite an interest in China. Can you tell us what that has involved and what issues you're focusing on when it comes to China?
Sure. Well, it goes back a long ways because, I was initially interested in communist systems. Oh, okay. I studied in the Soviet Union. I used to teach a course here at Stanford called The Political Economy of Post-Communism, where we looked at China, Russia, the post-communist world in Eastern Europe. So it was initially this interest in how these kinds of systems reform, and particularly the relationship between political institutions and economic growth. Mm. Later in life, and then like the last 5 years, I'm writing a book. Let me rephrase that. I'm aspiring to write a book about great power competition in the 21st century. And looking at how the West deals with China and Asia, Russia and Europe, Iran and the Middle East.
Oh, wow.
It's a big book, and it's something I've thought about for a long time, but finally want to try to think systematically about it. And I start in all those places. I know the Russia case the best, obviously, and I'm just learning about China. But I want to look at it historically to see what is the relationship between power, regime type, and leaders as these bilateral relationships change.
Yeah, there's been a lot of really interesting literature just on sort of the institutions of authoritarianism.
Right.
And of course, with this backslide that we're seeing, this democratic backslide and the rise of more and more authoritarian states, it's really urgent that we understand that.
I agree.
It's going to be
But I'm also worried, on the policy side, I'm suspicious of the consensus in America among my kind of national security elites about the necessity of a new Cold War with China.
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm almost always naturally suspicious of any consensus. Like, that's just kind of who I am. But it is striking to me that this has come out of the blue in some ways in the last couple of years. And so I just want to interrogate the hypothesis. And to do so means I have to learn more about China. So I go to China quite a bit. I spent last summer in China.
Yeah, you did.
4 years ago, I spent the whole summer there. And I'll never be a China specialist, but I'm trying to get smarter about all things Chinese.
Well, just last summer, like you said, you were there. And after coming back, you penned an op-ed that you put in the Washington Post, I believe, if that's correct. You were a month in residence at Peking University. And you wrote, you know, about your rather depressing conclusion that China is actually winning the ideological contest with the U.S. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, it was more commentary on us than them.
Right.
Which is to say, you know, in the Cold War, which I know well, and by the way, when I say I'm nervous about the Cold War, I think some of the people new to this debate about China don't know about the history of the Cold War. Right. They make a lot of assumptions about the Cold War that I think are incorrect. They've remembered it in a particular way because we now have won the Cold War. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel like we were winning the Cold War in the 60s and 70s. And why we won the Cold War, I think people forget.
Right.
For me, a big part of winning the Cold War was about the war of ideas, freedom versus not, markets versus command economies. And I think on that dimension, especially in the Trump era, we don't have the kind of high ground anymore when it comes to democracy, human rights, rule of law. And China offers an alternative to that. And if we're not even championing the things we used to, we're not going to win that ideological struggle.
That's absolutely right. You talk about three arguments that Americans used to take comfort in when it came to that. One, that China was moving toward more market liberalization.
Right.
That China was moving, if not already, you know, toward pluralism, then at least more toward tolerance, a less repressive political system, and that so many Chinese seem to genuinely admire the U.S. But are all these things, you know, you argue that they've seen in this time of Trump, these arguments have grown weaker, right? Are they dead, though? I mean, couldn't a different American administration, a different leadership, different terms of competition with China really revive those same hopes?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm an optimist, and I'm a long-term optimist about liberalism with a small L, right? Not liberals and conservatives, but I think it's premature to declare that liberalism is dead. Vladimir Putin did that a couple months ago in a very famous interview. He said other powers, and he was I think he was thinking of places like China and Iran, were rising with a different set of ideas. And I think, you know, it's way too premature to call this the end. And that's another good lesson from the Cold War, by the way. There were periods during the Cold War. First, we had the debate about who lost China, and it seemed like China and the Soviet Union was a bloc, and we were in decline. Then the 70s, you had it in an even more acute way, where we had our troubles, you know, real difficult troubles at home, domestically, and communism seemed to be on the rise throughout the world, and in Indochina and Southern Africa, and even Latin America. And in retrospect, we probably overreacted to those moments.
Yeah.
So I think we need to have a little more confidence in the things that have made our societies great.
Couldn't agree with you more.
I mean, and don't forget also, I would say, although now I'm getting into territory that I'm not an expert, I think sometimes there's a reification of the enemy that then suggests all Chinese think alike. And we did that during the Cold War too, right? We thought they were all communists. They all believed in the same thing. By the way, all communist countries thought alike. That was a huge mistake we made during the Cold War. And I just want to keep open the proposition that maybe all Chinese don't think alike. And that would be really very superficial for us to think that they're all rallying behind this kind of illiberal international against the West.
You're obviously correct. And we all have friends and people. I mean, I'm just not talking just about the intelligentsia that I have some, you know, contact with in Beijing, but also with my kind of dumb, uneducated rocker friends. A lot of them are, you know, they're very critical of Xi. I mean, a lot of them are disappointed or worse with him.
Uh-huh.
And yet, I find that it is harder than it has been in the past to sell the merits of liberal democracy.
Yes, I agree.
They look at what we're doing, what we've done here. They look at what they've been able to accomplish, and it's really a tough sell. I mean, and
I agree.
At the same time, it's more urgent than ever to make that sale,
right?
Because of the authoritarian backslide that we're seeing all over the place. That's got to be a source of pretty big frustration.
Well, I would say two things to that. I agree, but in two different dimensions. One is the way we're practicing democracy in the United States is not inspirational for anybody. I travel a lot around the world, and the way we're doing it now, we're not inspiring a lot of people to say, oh, we want to be just like them.
Right.
So we've got to get our own house in order first. I agree with that. The second thing, though, I think is important. Again, I'm going to say 100 times, I'm not a China expert. I just see it in a comparative context, right?
Well, anyone who says they are isn't.
Well, I'm glad you said that, not me, because you are an expert on these things, and I'm just a student. But you know, in comparative context, remember that China has done better at taking more people out of poverty than any country in human history in the last four decades. That is a fact. It's also a fact that they did so not by doubling down on communist totalitarian dictatorship. They did it by rejecting that period. We
had
20 years of that in China, and millions of people died. And so it was the moving away from that that helped to this economic miracle. And I think that gets conflated sometimes in these discussions. They think it's the Communist Party, the strong state, the guided thing. Well, actually, it's a much more complicated story than that. And it was liberalization on the economic side that helped that economic growth.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was a little flippant when I used to say that they mostly just got out of the way.
Yes.
But well, I think that takes it too far, too, because there were important institutional reforms that could only have been done by a strong state. And there were wise and prescient infrastructure investments that probably could have been done only
with a strong state.
Yeah, with a strong state.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
But they did get out of the way. I still agree with you.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
And the entrepreneurial spirit of Chinese culture is
job
much
growth
older.
Comes from the private sector.
Yes.
Most, you know, profit growth comes from the private sector. Well, that's without saying. But yeah, job growth. And it's a huge percentage of job growth. 80 or 90% of job growth comes from the private sector in China today. Now, one of the things that I found really interesting about that op-ed that you wrote was you talked about whataboutism and how you had to actually engage in a little bit of it yourself. And usually, I mean, how does it feel with the shoe on the other foot? Because usually we're the ones pointing at Moscow or Beijing and saying, hey, that's just whataboutism.
Right.
So tell us, for those of you who haven't read the article, when did you have to play at that game?
Well, when I was ambassador in Russia, whenever we would try to criticize certain actions of Vladimir Putin, his regime and his media channels would always pivot to whataboutism. So,
yeah. What about black incarceration in America? Or what
exactly.
about the genocide of the Native Americans?
Exactly. Yes, you know your Cold War history well. And by the way, those are things they used to say in the Cold War, and they say them now.
Brought them right back.
And you know, I would try to say, my argument as an ambassador was one, you know, I'm an academic first and foremost. I've been working at Stanford for 30 years. But I would always say facts matter, evidence matters. Two wrongs don't make a right. So maybe even if you were right, and I wouldn't cede the point, but let's, a classic whataboutism with Putin would be, well, we went into Ukraine and annexed Crimea, but you did the same in Serbia, right? You went into Kosovo. Now, those two cases are radically different.
Right.
But even if they were the same, my argument would be, well, two wrongs don't make a right.
Sure.
If you thought it was wrong there, then that doesn't justify you doing it here.
Right. And now you've had to engage in a little bit of it on your own. As you said,
uncomfortably.
Under what sorts of circumstances?
Well, I just in the Trump era, you know, I see some of the same tactics of President Trump and his defenders that the Putin folks use, right?
So
in addition to whataboutism, there's this diversionary thing that they always do, right? So when we're focused on a debate about annexation, they want to change the channel. They want to talk about something else.
Right.
Most certainly President Trump seems really good at that, to try to, you know, create some distraction over here so we all run over and talk about that. But I found myself, in attacking some of the misconduct of the president using whataboutism. And I don't like it, and I shouldn't do it.
Yeah. Now, we should all try to stay away from that. People really do associate you, obviously, with Russia and with for better or for worse, democracy promotion, however you want to interpret that. It's something that critics would say that you pursued pretty zealously in Russia. You were accused constantly of seeking to foment regime change there. And that's, you know, the subject of your book is very extensive. But how would you succinctly characterize what your actual approach was when it came to promoting democratic values and institutions in a nominally democratic Russia?
So, you know, remember I worked 3 years at the White House before I went to Moscow.
It
so,
was at NSA.
That was at the NSC. Working for the NSA, National Security Advisor, right? So, you know, I worked with Obama in the campaign. We won, you know, the day after the inauguration, I showed up at the White House for my first government job. And that meant that I was there for the creation of our strategy towards Russia. You know, I was the kind of quarterback that whole process, the interagency process for developing it. And when it came to these issues, we had two principles that at least we wrote down. We didn't always practice it, but it was the policy. One, we're not going to check our values at the door when we go to negotiate about Iran or a strategic arms control limitation. We're going to keep talking about these things. We're not going to pretend that if I don't say something about these violations of human rights, that somehow is going to endear us to the Kremlin. But two, and this was the controversial piece, controversial when Putin came back. It wasn't controversial originally.
When Medvedev was still
in when power. Medvedev was around, it was fine. It was something we called dual-track diplomacy. And our theory was, our strategy was, we're going to engage with the government, but we're also going to engage directly with society. And that's going to be part of our diplomacy. And that engagement is not to do regime change. You know, Barack Obama is not a big regime changer guy. So the idea that he sent me to Russia to overthrow Putin is absurd. But the idea was we want to disabuse Russians of some of the propaganda and misinformation that we saw about our country. So that meant meeting with people when I was ambassador, and it meant showcasing American culture. By the way, it was one of the most fantastic parts of my job. Like, I would get to bring, especially like music. My father's a former musician, like you. different kind of music, by the way. But one of my jobs was like to bring musicians from America to perform in Moscow and at my house as a way to say, this is who we are. It's not just about, you know, what you read in the newspapers.
Right.
And by the way, music was one of the best ways to connect directly with Russians. They love and appreciate music.
Or anyone, for that matter.
Anyway, but what I got in trouble with Putin for two things. One, when we said engage with society, we also meant the opposition. When we flew there in 2009 with President Obama, he also, by the way, met with all the opposition leaders of Russia. And it was no big deal. Nobody even read about it. It wasn't even in the news because we were in a more cooperative time.
Right.
When I showed up in 2012, there had been massive demonstrations against the Putin regime. They were feeling very unstable. And so when we did the same exact thing, and by the way, usually wasn't me. It was usually some dignitary visiting from Washington. It felt like we were, you know, trying to overthrow the regime. So that was the one space, and he would criticize us for that.
Well, they say a sore palate filleth the grit. And so when he's already feeling that insecurity, I think that's sometimes a failing on the part of American foreign policy is that we don't exercise quite enough security dilemma sensibility.
I think that's right. I agree with that in retrospect.
When we transpose this to the key of China, hypothetically, you know, were you to be appointed again to say a position in the State Department where you were, you know, maybe Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia Pacific or something like that, or in an ambassadorial capacity under a hypothetical democratic administration with China on your mind, would you approach things differently? I mean, presumably because Russia was at least nominally democratic, it was sort of okay for you to meet with the opposition.
Yes.
Maybe not so much in China. That would maybe be more provocative.
That's a great question, because there are some very big contrasts. There's not, you know, I know who the opposition leader of Russia is.
Right.
His name's Alexei Navalny.
Yeah.
He has run against Putin. You know, he's leading a grassroots movement. They have legal opposition in Russia. It seems different to me in China.
Oh, very much. Yeah.
And so I think you raise an important question, how you would do that kind of engagement. But there's also a flip side to it. There's a different side to it, which is paradoxical. Like when I go to play basketball over here at Stanford, as I do from time to time with my sons, including Cole, especially during the break, 95% of the people playing basketball over there are from China.
That's right.
And there are no Russians over there. So we have way more connectivity with Chinese society.
Absolutely.
Because of business. Yeah. And students and Chinese Americans than we do with Russia. And that's the paradox of the two relationships. On the one hand, it's more controlled in China. On the other hand, there's way more interaction between just Chinese and Americans. And so I don't want to presuppose I would know how to do it. I think your point is an important one, that times have changed, and they've changed in China too, by the way. It's not the way it was 10 years ago. But I would hope that some administration would at least, you know, keep the proposition alive that we should engage with both the government and society.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. I do believe that's true. I'm curious, though, whether the abiding and deep suspicion that Putin and his cronies had toward you has sort of maybe affected still the way that you're seen and the way that you're treated when you go to China. Do people say, oh, here's this McFall guy and he's, you know, this is that harbinger of,
yes,
you know, liberal interventionism. You know, this is the guy who's channeling Samantha Powers or whatever.
Yes. I think that is true.
Yeah, they do regard you that
way. At least the elites
way.
Know who I am, and the intelligence services know who I am. Thankfully, I still have a visa. I'm banned in Russia, you know, now.
Yeah,
I'm on the visa ban list there, and I'm banned in Iran. I've been to Iran before, but I can't get a visa there today. And I hope that doesn't happen in China. You know, the way I like to frame it is, you know, now I am I'm an academic. I'm trying to write. I'm trying to understand. And I would hope that there would be enough wisdom and I used to say this as a diplomat all the time. We're going to have our differences with Russia, and no amount of talking is going to settle those differences. We're never going to agree with Putin, for instance, about Crimea.
Right.
But what we can't do is have conflicts in U.S.-Russia relations based on misperception or bad information or misunderstanding. And that's kind of my argument about China, too. I'm worried about it, by the way. I see a lot of giant assumptions in both countries, by the way, made when I'm in China. I hear things said about my country, and I think, wow, that doesn't sound like the America I know. And usually in Washington, when I interact with a lot of, you know, national security elite types, I hear assumptions made about China. And as an academic, I want to know, well, where's your evidence to support that hypothesis, right? So I see my role as an academic these days as an explainer, not as an advocate for this, that, or, you know, let alone a revolution.
So, I mean, I think one of the things you might have had in mind when you're talking about the you know, incorrect assumptions that are being made in China about the United States must have to do with this, their belief that we are still assertively promoting some species of regime change.
Yes.
That, you know, I mean, you've heard plenty of this coming from not only Russian, but also your Chinese interlocutors.
Right.
There's no doubt about neo-containment, about this policy of
right.
color revolution.
Right.
You know, looking at the lessons of the Arab Spring and all that stuff.
Yes. I heard a lot of that last
Yeah,
summer,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably nowhere is this more acute right now than in Hong Kong. When you look at Hong Kong, where people who I regard as very, very sensible in China just accept pretty uncritically the idea that this claim about black hands operating behind
right.
the scenes, about, you know,
right.
the NED or the CIA
right.
funneling money to these people. You know, this goes back further, though, than just Hong Kong. It goes back further than just – it goes back really to the Obama administration,
yep.
right? You know, to 2008, 2009 and that period where, you know, this whole discourse on internet freedom, for example,
mm-hmm.
On universal values, just even the most innocuous public diplomacy efforts on our part were sometimes seen through a really kind of negative light as part of this whole liberal interventionist
right.
push,
right.
a master plan. So – is there, how do you finesse this? How do you communicate this with the people who you talk to in China? I mean, because I have to admit, when I put myself in those shoes and I look across at us And when it looks like different sectors of society seem to move in exactly the same way at the same time. And I tried to tell them, look, this is not coordination. We're not that good, first of all.
Right.
It's just, this is like the programming that comes of values, of shared values, that the New York Times editorial board has similar values to these non-governmental organizations, has similar values to the U.S. State Department, has, and it's not coordination, but this falls on deaf ears.
Yeah.
How do you convince, this is the most frustrating, if I could learn how to do that, I think I could really
I think you're onto something that's really hard for a couple of reasons. Number one, in the past, the United States has promoted regime change, sometimes through overt power, like we did in Iraq, sometimes through covert power. Mm-hmm. That's a fact.
Yep.
In fact, I remember the first time we had this debate with Putin. Obama and Putin sat down, and Putin just laid this out, right? He has this theory that we're always overthrowing regimes, and the truth is, sometimes we have been. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it hard. I can tell you as an ambassador in Russia, that was very hard when they say, well, look, you did this in Serbia. You know, the CIA gave $40 million to the opposition. Why should we not presume you're doing the same right now? So that's a dilemma. The history is there. What I would try to do as ambassador is to say that we're not a unitary actor, the United States. There's not some, and I can tell you, you know, I remember I showed up at the White House and nobody handed me the blue book of American national interest, right? And said, okay, now this is what you're supposed to do. It doesn't exist.
Right. So it's fluid.
It's fluid. And Obama is radically different than Bush. When he told, I remember when he told Putin, he said, well, you may not know this, but I was against that war. And Putin kind of looked at him like, what do you mean you're against that war? You guys all think alike. And Obama was radically against that war. So that, the first thing is to say we're different and we do things in different ways. The second thing to say, and I spent a lot of time last summer in China at the various, especially public things I did. It got really heated one night at Renmin. It was a great event. Like 500 people were there and a pretty charged event. And, you know, somebody asked this question and I was like, you're deeply misreading American spirit right now. You know, I'm about to fly to Montana where I'm from. Nobody in Montana wants to do regime change in China. We are in an isolationist moment in American history right now where, and Trump exemplifies that. You think he's out there doing regime change? He's saying we should pull back and put up barriers and literally build walls.
That's true. And yet there's Steve Bannon, who isn't technically part of his, you know,
good
administration,
point.
But he, you know, just recently at that, the Bloomberg conference, he said it very plainly. He said the real agenda is regime change when it comes to China. It is ending the reign of the Chinese Communist Party.
And that's a great point because that gets back to our pluralism.
That
even when I was in the Obama administration, this thing we're discussing right now, we had big debates about this.
Oh, yeah.
Especially during the Arab Spring, right? Like, what are we doing here, folks?
Sit down, Samantha. We've all read your book.
That didn't happen. But Samantha worked right next to me at the NSC. Yeah. She was literally the door over from me.
I've seen that reported so many times, though. That didn't happen, though.
It may have happened, not when I was in the room.
Okay.
I wasn't always in the room.
Yeah.
But I want to say one other thing on this because it's important.
Oh, it is.
You can have your values and not necessarily believe that it's important to propagate them or to change you, the other person, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that needs to be respected. In Russia, they would always say, well, you're doing regime change or we're doing regime change. And I would argue back, well, why don't you guys stop doing regime change on us? Why are you calling on me to stop believing what I believe just because, you know, you believe something different? So there's got to be a two-way street about this tolerance stuff. Like if I believe in democratic values and human rights, I should be able to have a conversation. This is now the Russian government with you without you asking me to check my values. And I think that's an important, it's who we are as America. Not everybody, I want to be careful, but some Americans, this is what they think is right. So be respectful of our culture as well.
How does cultural relativism have to play into this? I mean, it was a time when people on our side of the political fence, Democrats, tended to be pretty much we were cultural relativists.
Yep.
We were very sensitive to it. You are a deeply read historian. I mean, I'm looking around your office right now, and
yeah, got a lot of books on revolutions right there. By the way, now that I think about it, we're talking about revolutions. But I want to make sure your listeners understand. I used to teach a course on revolutions. I'm not a professional revolutionary.
Big difference.
Yes.
There's been a big shift right now where people on our side, I mean, the Democrat Party and people who are liberals and progressives, now we are absolutist in the universality of American values, not American values, but of liberal democratic values.
Right. Universal values, Obama used to call it.
Minor conditional, I kind of think that what is possible, the rapidity with which a society can move toward those is conditioned by history, right?
Yes, I mean, of course. I think
it's the universal in that it's sort of a pole star. It's still something to which we ought to be moving, but the realities are very much conditioned by history, by that inertia.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
So I agree, and two, you know, I had some pretty interesting, and I still do, with colleagues. About what values we put above others, right?
So right.
One of my Chinese interlocutors over the summer was saying, well, you know, we're doing a pretty good job on economic growth. You guys aren't. I flew into LAX and what a dump compared to our airports, number one. And then number two, will their society, culture, state be better at dealing with questions of inequality? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
It doesn't look that way right now.
Doesn't look that way right now. But you know, it's what are you putting above all others? And you know, I mean, I'm pretty clear on what I think, and I'm pretty clear about the history in terms of modernization over hundreds of years. But I in no way would ever say that we, the United States, have got kind of a monopoly on truth about these things, or a monopoly on superiority. We most certainly do not.
Mike, not too long ago, I did a show. It was about Hong Kong, and I made a very dismissive remark about this belief about the NED funding this and that in Hong Kong. And a reader who clearly is not just some sort of, you know, nutcase at all, he said, you know, I was surprised at how dismissive you were. I ask you to go on to the NED website, and here's the page. You can search for what they're actually doing in terms of funding. Uh-huh. And so I did that, and I entered a date parameter, and I looked for the keyword Hong Kong. Turns out it's not a lot of money. It's $1.75 million over the last 5 years. But the NED is funding different civil society organizations. These are a range of things. Some of it is, you know, labor organization.
Right.
And you know, and I said that. I wrote back to him, and I thought, you know, hey, this stuff seems pretty innocuous to me.
Right.
And my sense, though, writing about this and talking to other people was that some just shook their heads at me and said, you know, it's really naive for you to believe that money isn't going to fund this, that, or the other things, you know, could be gas masks or,
right.
Or to, you know, it doesn't cost that much. I said, well, look, it's only $1.75 million over 5 years. They said, how much money does it take to write a stirring anthem?
Uh-huh.
Right. I suppose I have to, you know, grudgingly concede that they may have a point. Is this a mistake for us to allow our civil society organizations to, you know, the Chinese have this great saying that says, don't tie your shoes in your neighbor's melon patch. And don't stretch your arms under your neighbor's plum trees. Just don't give the appearance that you might be doing wrong.
Yeah.
Are we giving the appearance that, I mean, are we feeding this suspicion?
Right. So I know NED well, the National Endowment for Democracy. Mm-hmm. I know that organization well, and their sister organizations, NDI, IRI,
right.
AFL-CIO, their Solidarity Center and SITE. I think it's a, and I want to confess, like my views on this are shifting, given where we're at today compared to where we were in the 90s. I opened the NDI office in Moscow in 1992. What was different about that compared to now? Number one, they just had a revolution, a democratic revolution, and we were the invited guests of the Russian government.
Right.
And our principal mandate was education. It was like, here's how federalism works. Here's how electoral law works, right? We weren't fomenting revolution. Number two, we had a strictly nonpartisan mandate. So anything that had to do with electoral politics, we couldn't support one party over another.
Right.
We had to support institutions and democracy. But, because I experienced this in Russia, and I think it's very similar to what you're describing in Hong Kong. I don't know the funding groups in Hong Kong, so I will avoid commentary on that. But Vladimir Putin got very upset at us in 2011. They had an election, and it turned out that it was falsified. And civil society exposed that falsification, and that triggered hundreds of thousands of people on the streets.
That was in 2012?
2011, 2012.
Yeah,
right. It started in 2011, got big in 2012.
Right.
One of the NGOs that exposed that falsification received money from a U.S. government foundation, from NDI.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our argument and NDI's argument was, well, free and fair elections, that's everybody's for that. That's not, there's nothing wrong with that. Universal values, right?
Right.
But Vladimir Putin saw that as undermining his legitimacy. And so that's a problem, right? This group is called GOLIS. It's called Voice. They stopped getting money from foreign groups precisely because they decided it's better for us to go it alone, even with less money, so we're not being accused of this kind of foreign intervention, you know, being the puppets of the U.S. And so my kind of rule of thumb today is let those people in the countries decide what's right for them and how they interact with outsiders. And I mentioned this guy, Navalny, right?
Yeah.
Leader of the opposition in Russia. We never met once when I was a U.S. ambassador. Not a single time. Even though on the TV, you would think we were best buddies, right? Russian propaganda, I mean. And that's because he rightly decided it's not in his political interest to have a photo op with the U.S. ambassador. That's going to undermine him. It's going to undermine his credibility for what he was doing. And I think sometimes Americans are a little too, one, we think we understand their local conditions better than we do. That's always a giant mistake around the world. And two, we're a little too eager sometimes to take credit for what, after all, other people are doing.
Right.
Let those other people do it. Conversely, autocrats, generally speaking, always have to see some hidden hand behind people power because they can't believe that demonstrators in Hong Kong or demonstrators in Russia would do this on their own.
Right.
Of course, it has to be the CIA is behind it because otherwise these people wouldn't do that. And that's their misunderstanding of their own citizens.
Absolutely. So if you had the opportunity to take the ear of the next ambassador to, you've been the ambassador to one big illiberal state.
Yes.
The incoming ambassador in a Warren administration or a Buttigieg administration or even a second Trump administration where Terry Branstad to be replaced. What kind of advice would you give to him? Would it be along the lines of what you just said?
Yeah.
I mean, a little, you know, dial down the hubris.
Yeah.
Be a little more sensitive to the optics of situations, you know.
And engage more with society.
Yeah.
So don't, part of what I tried to do as ambassador was be completely transparent. I got on Twitter. I was one of the first ambassadors to be on Twitter.
So follow you on Twitter. It's great.
So that everybody knew everything I was doing, right? No secret meetings with a bunch of money under the table. Be transparent. And, you know, I do think, you know, remember, one of your jobs as the ambassador is to understand the country and to help your decision makers back home understand the country. You do that by engagement. You do that by getting out and being part of society. Mm. So that I think you can do in a way that should not be misconstrued as being kind of revolutionary.
I'm curious now, having looked at Russia and lived in Russia and studied Russia for so very long, and now looking at China, do you sense that in our community, whether it's the IC or just the broader policy community, or even just in, you know, among the American cognoscenti, is there a tendency to view China and Russia through sort of the same lens?
Yes. And it's really simplistic and scary. And it has to do with this Cold War thing. So, you know, we are now entering a time where there are two superpowers in the world. Nobody else is going to be close to China and the United States looking out for 100 years. China has a communist party. China is seeking to advance its interests beyond its borders. And so there's this very natural, in fact, they're some of the same people. The Cold Warriors, right, from before are now like reemerging, you know, as the champions here.
the new committee on the present danger is
Yes, exactly. And I would just say, again, I'm not an expert on China, but we can make some really big mistakes by doing that.
One of the areas where I see a lot of conflation or maybe you know too much eagerness to draw parallels is in so-called influence operations. I think that you know the Russian influence operations are very well attested.
Yes.
We have 17 or 18 intelligence agencies all concluding that they meddled in our and they're extensive, and we look at what even what they do out in the open. If you look at RT or any of these things, you know, they're trying to sort of pull the epistemic rug from out under the American, setting us against one another. They're pushing our hot buttons. I look at Chinese influence operations such as they are, and I do not see many points of comparison.
Yeah.
I think they're almost entirely defensive. They try to dilute or distract or sort of, or, you know, dogmatically defend against a criticism of China.
Right.
And that, while it's not a good thing, it's qualitatively different from, you know, an assault on our institutions, right?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I want to learn more, but I think generally speaking, the qualitative nature of the two operations are very different. I mean, which is not to say that there aren't, you know, instances of Chinese influence in the United States and abroad. And my colleagues here at the Hoover Institution wrote a big study of that. But when I look at that, one, it doesn't compare to what the Russians are doing today. But two, and more importantly, it in no way compares to what the Soviet Union was doing during the Cold War.
That's a very good point.
And this assumption, you know, again, I don't know China that well, but I know the Cold War really well. You should come to my other office over at Hoover, where I have literally, you know, a thousand books on the Cold War over there. And, you know, back then, the Soviet Union had a positive ideology. They thought that history was on their side, and that capitalism was the penultimate stage before socialism, and that eventually the whole world would be communist. Now, some people believed it, some didn't, but they, the founders of the country, and definitely through Khrushchev and even Brezhnev for half of his life, this was something they engaged in and pushed around. And by the way, it had appeal as a set of ideas. It had an appeal
to,
around the world. And here at Stanford University, it had appeal. I was a kid here at Stanford during the Cold War. You know, I had a photo of Lenin at one point. And so there was an active program of propagation of Marxism-Leninism.
Mm-hmm. Messianic.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And, it's an ideological struggle, and one side will win. It's hard to look at what the Chinese are doing with the China Today inserts in the Washington Post or you know, their Confucius centers to see that similar thing. And moreover, it's not even, as I would say, again, I don't know it as well as I need to, but to say that there's a coherent set of ideas that are being propagated, it's most certainly not communism, for goodness sakes. I'm suspicious of it. And the other part of it, I would say, that's very different than the Cold War, is in the Cold War, we were the enemy, had to be defeated, and we fought it out in places like Vietnam and Angola on the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
China has a strategy towards, you know, developing relations in Africa. They also have a strategy of developing trade and investment with the United States. And they invest in the developing democratic world, and you cannot misconstrue that economic activity as somehow propagating autocracy or communism. That just doesn't make any sense to me. And I think that, therefore, it's an apples and oranges kind of comparison.
There's a really good piece in Foreign Affairs by Jessica Chen Weiss called Making the World Safe for Autocracy, which I thought really, you know, got it pretty
yes,
perfectly.
I remember that piece.
Very good piece. Yeah.
I think she's a Stanford PhD, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so. She's a terrific.
Thanks for the tip.
Writer. Yeah, I'll check it out. What do you make of the seemingly warmer relationship that we have now seen between Putin and Xi Jinping? Is this something with any possibility of enduring or further deepening, or is this just an expedient? Is it just based on this shared and hopefully temporary perception of a need to join hands to, you know, counterbalance an America that's pretty hell-bent on its own kind of regime change mischief?
Well, short term, I give them both credit. It's a relationship that's working for both countries. I think it's working especially for Russia, being isolated and weak in the world. To have a country like China that allegedly is your partner, that's a good thing for them. And this, you know, alliance of autocracies against the liberal world. You know, I would have said 5 years ago that the Chinese Communist Party, and I'm deliberately saying not just President Xi, was having their cake and eating it too back then. Right. Lately, they haven't been able to do that. And I wonder if there will become a time when other leaders, future leaders, or even within the, you know, within the party, will begin to think, well, hey, maybe this alliance with all these, you know, autocracies who are kind of dragging us down is not really helping us out. But not right now. That's most certainly right. Not right now. Long term, I don't think it lasts. I think Russia is the junior partner here. They know it. They don't like it. I think there'll be tensions, you know, 20, 30 years out.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I do want to be respectful of your time. So let's move on to the recommendation section of our program. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's been terrific. I got to say, I'm in such perfect accord with the way, I mean, not knowing really how you'd come down on these issues related to democracy promotion in China. It's really good to hear such a nuanced perspective. So, recommendations. Let me first remind our listeners, though, that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. And if you like what we're doing with Seneca and with the other shows in the Seneca network, the very best way you can support our work is to subscribe to SubChina's daily newsletter. This thing is really chock full of all the great reads there are on China, delivered to your inbox every weekday. And our team works very, very hard to bring you this product. Sign up and spread the word. Now, on to recommendations. You got a good book for us, Mike, something that we should be all...
So, in the things I'm writing today, remember, I'm a political scientist in the discipline of political science. And for many, many years, I would even say decades, we've kind of written out of our stories about international relations the role of leaders. We don't know how to we don't know how to capture them in numbers. We don't know how to measure their impact, right? So we just kind of forget about them. And I've always thought that leaders matter. And after serving in the government, I came back to Stanford thinking even more so leaders matter. And, you know, the change to Putin from Yeltsin had a big impact on what happened in Russia.
Absolutely.
I think the change from Obama to Trump really underscores that leaders matter in the United States. And I want to learn more about whether that's true in China or not. I've read one book and I'm about to read this one. So I've read Elizabeth Economy's book on leadership. David Lampton has a book about leadership, which I was just reading on my last trip to China. And then this one by Han Xuetong.
Yeah, Yan Xuetong. Yeah.
You must know who he
Yan
is.
Xuetong, yeah.
I've met him a few times over at Tsinghua. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've just started reading it, but the fact I met with him a few times over the summer. He's a little cautious on the way he talks about China, I've noticed.
Yeah. He sure is.
But the idea that leaders should be part of our discussion of international relations, I think, is a really important thing. And there's one other book, I won't remember her the title of it, but she's fantastic. Her name's Elizabeth Saunders. She's at George Washington University, and she's writing about it with respect to the United States.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm trying to do this in a comparative perspective.
Yeah, I think that you're really onto something there. One thing about Xi Jinping is that, you know, he does see himself as this world historic character.
Right.
He really does. I mean, and when leaders see themselves as sort of these Carlylean figures, you got to think that that does have an impact on their style of rule. Absolutely.
And to me, you know, in our era of leaders, right? You got Putin, Xi, Modi, Erdogan, Trump. You have this era where there are these strong, charismatic personalities. Some would call them autocratic personalities. And I think we need to just understand how they impact things, how they're leading, and how they're expressing their societies.
That's a fantastic recommendation. Yeah, a whole set of them. Let me suggest that there's a new podcast out by Jane Perlez.
Oh.
She just stepped down
from the New York Times.
She did. She's in the States right now. She's at Harvard, and she just started a new podcast. And it's basically her quest to understand the person of Xi Jinping.
Oh. That's a great tip.
I have
tip.
Not given it a listen yet. I just saw the email this morning, you know, just
I'll basically check it out.
Announcing it. So I am going to check that out for
all
sure.
All right. Thanks for the tip.
Yeah. My recommendation is a little more bland. It's the writer John McPhee. One of my best friends has been a big fan of his. I asked him for a good recommendation to start, and he recommended called? Basin and Range, which is a geography of the Basin and Range area, which – I mean, you're from what part of Montana? From the western part? Or?
Western part.
Western Montana. So it's.
But I was born on the other side.
Oh, okay, so. Okay. The geography. And what's up with all the Montanans in China?
That I don't know.
I mean, there's Baucus.
Baucus. He lives in my hometown now.
Tiff Roberts from Business Week, Montana, and he's back in Missoula now.
And there's a tidbit you probably don't know. Our current Senator Steve Daines, he's first-term senator, Republican. He spent 6 or 7 years of his life living in China.
Wow.
His kids speak Chinese. They used to live across the street from my sister.
Oh, wow.
So watch for him. I predict that he will become a kind of big player on U.S.-China relations.
It sounds like I need to take a trip out there and talk to him.
Yeah, you'd be welcome to come.
Absolutely. That would be great. So, yeah, Basin and Range, it's terrific. McPhee writes with this spare but really highly literary, very masculine style.
Okay.
He was the sort of the mentor to one of my favorite China writers, probably my favorite China writer, Peter Hessler. And you can see sort of stylistic similarities in there.
Okay.
So
I'll check it out. Range.
Yeah. Thanks so much. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me, Kaiser.
Yeah. And we got you out on time. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out our other podcasts in the network. Watch this space for announcements of new podcast shows coming soon. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week. Take care.